Good afternoon. This is Russ Stewart, and you are listening to Inside Navy Supply. We are recording at the National Conference Center in Leesburg, Virginia today, where about 250 Supply Corps officers have gathered from around the world to attend the Supply Corps Senior Leadership Symposium. With me today is Rear Admiral Julie Traynor, U.S. Fleet Forces Command Director of Logistics and Ordnance in Norfolk, Virginia.
Yes, good afternoon, Russ. I appreciate the opportunity to sit down with you today.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I know the symposium has got a lot of stuff going on out there, and it's a great opportunity to collaborate, get reacquainted with old friends, make new friends, and do that thing where everyone comes together and things become more than they were before. And so I know how valuable that time is, and we really appreciate you coming here. So before we get into leadership, right, we want to know, like, what leadership is to a Navy Supply Corps officer. I'm going to ask you an icebreaker question, okay? So it's a little bit out there, a little bit different. So in your experience, in your opinion, what is your favorite naval tradition? What tradition do you find most meaningful and why?
I think my favorite naval tradition is occurs at the closure of one's career, and that's a retirement ceremony, ironically, for all of the traditions that we have inside the Navy. And I think it's because it is always, to this day, regardless of the number of years of service, highly emotional to think about one's service and sacrifice, to see a family who has been without that service member finally be able to sit center stage, for shipmates to come round and tell sea stories, extol the person's accolades, tell stories of companionship and camaraderie in foreign ports, and to take the time finally and for the family to come together across generations sometimes, inside and outside of uniforms, spanning sometimes decades of service, and for the entire Navy to finally pause, and for the ceremonial bells, the passing of the flag, the reading of the watch, for all attention to be on that member and their contribution. So I think for me that's one of the most sentimental of traditions that we have, and I also think it is one of the most worthwhile. We are very, very busy in our careers as Navy professionals, and so often we run through our jobs making it not about us, making the system run, making the outcome achievable, making everything else and everyone else's jobs run more smoothly. As supply officers, we're supporting. So for me, I think the opportunity to finally stop and individualize something and take the time to give back and to help that member not only reflect back but to close a chapter in what has been years and years of sacrifice, I think for me that is probably one of the most touching and memorable traditions we have.
Wow. What a powerful answer. That's I want to wrap the podcast just on that. That's awesome. We could explore that so much more, but that is definitely a worthwhile tradition, and I have witnessed many a retirement ceremony, and I feel like I never put it into words, but you did such an excellent job. That is how it feels. It's amazing. Like, you know, after years of quiet service, like, we turn the spotlight on that person and recognize everything they've done. What a fitting wrap to, you know, as you put it, decades of service. Thank you for that answer.
Absolutely. And, you know, Russ, if I could just on that point, oftentimes some of these career professionals, they really are quiet heroes. Mm-hmm. And you see that because there's most often an hesitation even to have a ceremony. And often you will hear master chiefs, senior chiefs, commanders, captains, yeah, but it's not about me. Because it's never been about them. Mm-hmm. But for that moment, it should be about them. It's important for them. And they see that afterward. It's important for their families. And I think sometimes they just aren't used to the attention. But it is extremely well-deserved and well-earned. So, yeah, time well spent.
Well said. Thank you very much. All right. So, as I said earlier, we're going to focus on leadership. And the first question is going to focus on your leadership philosophy. How do you define effective leadership in the Navy, especially in today's evolving maritime environment?
Leadership, in my mind, from a very basic definition, is about a mindset and behaviors that allow a collective group of people to align on shared goals, and within that to achieve outcomes of significance that simultaneously let the individual as a contributing member of that team to achieve their individual potential. And all of that is completed in an environment, if it is resilient enough, and if it is forgiving enough, transparent enough, and if there is trust on both sides, that paradigm is achievable through a constant evolution and an environment of change. So it kind of is a system of systems in which we enable people and teams to achieve things maybe that weren't even known to them if properly supported and executed.
Yeah. So if I may focus on one thing, it sounds like it not only accomplishes the mission, but it also helps, you know, grow and benefits the individuals as members of the team.
100%. Ultimately, the success of our community and our Navy, as we talked about in the first question, is predicated on the individual, mm-hmm. right? And individuals are, from the time they enter our community to the time they leave, should always be learning a new skill, a new technical trade, a new environment, a new paradigm, a new acronym. And so in order for people to reach their true potential, the realization that we are all fallible, that we will make mistakes, that we don't know everything, but we can pursue our careers with an intellectual and a professional curiosity and a desire to always achieve and fill our space as best we can mm-hmm. alongside of our teammates and give our absolute best is paramount. And so I think it's both about the collective, but it's about the individual, because it's the senior leader's job, in my opinion, to set the conditions that allow people to have that freedom and have that trust that they can learn and fail and do better next time and iterate. And it's a continuous process of improvement, a continuous process of learning, because ultimately people like me will leave this service, and those junior leaders in which we've manifested the elements of change, the elements of learning, the elements of adventure and grit and lack of fear of failure, hopefully,
right.
will be the ones sitting in the chair, and that system should continue. It's when you don't allow that environment that people sometimes withhold information because they're worried about personal repercussions, professional repercussions, judgment, mm-hmm. those types of things. But I think in order to get the best out of people, what you want to do is set no bar, support them as best you can, equip them with the tools they need, and set them free.
Right.
Because more often than not, they're the most creative and the smartest people in the room if left unfettered.
Right. So a lot of that, is just building upon their potential. And to do that, it often requires that one-on-one mentorship. So what strategies do you employ to foster that culture of mentorship? How do you ensure that junior sailors feel supported in their development?
I think one of the things that is paramount to me, and maybe sometimes counterintuitive for people that come see me, is that the first thing I always hear is, "Admiral, I know you're very busy." So, and I assure them that I am absolutely never too busy to sit down with another member of the service, and I don't care how junior they are. I don't care if they are officer, if they are enlisted, if they are civilian. Mm-hmm. I say it and I mean it, and my team knows it. My door is always open. And I am always available because the investment in that individual is, again, it's a force multiplier. Mm-hmm. And any of the wisdoms or the experiences that I may have gained through my career, if it better enables them, if it allows us a connection at a human element that increases their commitment to the service, if they just feel seen or they have someone that they can speak to that maybe is outside of the chain of command, but they relate to me because I'm an athlete or a single mother or a female officer, mm-hmm. I am there to have that conversation. And it's some of the most valuable use of my time, in my opinion, to give back. And if in a human connection I can do that, then I will always be there to do that. But oftentimes people think I'm not available, and my team knows that the answer is always yes. And I just ask them to be patient in finding the time, but we will always find the time. And I think that lesson for me is derived from, back to the question on leadership. Some people think leadership is just about giving orders and people being yes people, but real leadership is inspiring the spirit. Because there's not a lot we can give. I can't give you increased paychecks. I can't promote you early for most cases, right? And we're restricted by operational schedule for how much time I can give you off. So really what we have to do to inspire and to lead is to connect with people's spirit, because that's where the real decisions are made. Do they feel valued? Do they feel seen? And at a basic level, that's what most people want. That I am recognized and my work contributions are respected, and that someone would take the time to stop and talk to me about that.
Right, and at the beginning, you said this word. You said counterintuitive. A lot of folks understand, or they think they understand, that when you put on this uniform, you're no longer an individual. You're just a cog in the machine. You're a number, not a name. And it sounds like true leadership is the opposite of that. You know, the like bizarro world. Just turn things upside down, and the individual does matter, because you for the machine to work, that individual needs to be valued, seen, mentored, and nurtured in a sense, right?
100%.
Clearly, this isn't kindergarten, and we're not going to nurture you in ways, and sometimes that nurturing could be a little uncomfortable.
Absolutely. There is absolutely a world where I can be both approachable and have incredibly high standards.
Right.
And both are attainable. And I think people's realization that there is a space in which we can achieve both is, it takes a little bit for that to set in. But inevitably, what I have seen is when you create the environment that contains both, you take the limits off of what a team and individuals actually can achieve, because they understand my expectation, and that's with zero guidance. I'm not going to tell them do one, step one, step two, step three.
Right.
My job is to set the mission objective and to set that bar high. And I will tell you that historically for me, in some of the most austere conditions with some people that maybe weren't seen as the most stellar performers. You know, I had divisions that were comprised of people that were all TAD, hazmat, one in my junior career. Brand new division, so people, of course, thought, well, I'm going to send down my problem child and put him in this division because it's a new thing and I'm not too bought in. And I recognized that when I first assembled the team. And, you know, I heard whispers of, well, this person, did you know this, did you know that? And my first discussion was with that division was that I didn't know who they were or what division they'd come from, and I didn't know what stories followed them into mine. But I had an expectation of them as individuals, and the past was the past. And now their recognition was in my division, and the first thing we started off with was a uniform inspection.
Right.
Now, that got met with a certain series of, you know, you start to see personalities. Some resisted. Some were like, okay, good, I have a clean sheet. I can start over again. I can restart my story. But what I saw after I did small things to shift the onus, right? I wasn't going to drag them. I was going to inspire them. I wasn't going to tell them. I was going to ask to cooperate with them. And I wasn't going to just put them into a machine. I was going to put their name above the door and say, this is now your storeroom, and in 3 weeks I'll be back and I'd like to inspect it. Let's walk through and see a couple things. And I will tell you, it was my first experience where I saw the absolute unbridled capability of the human potential. Absolutely left with a clean slate and anything that they needed to do it. They closed those doors, and when I came back, it was night and day.
Right.
They had torn down to literally the deck and then sanded the deck and painted the deck and rebuilt every single storeroom and were so prideful to do it. And it brought a tear to my eye. And so when I sent those same sailors back to their divisions, it wasn't two, it wasn't three, it wasn't four, it was five different phone calls from those division officers who said, I sent you one sailor, you sent me back a different sailor.
That's incredible. And, you know, it reminds me, like one of the most powerful things said to me was in a very similar situation, except for I was the sailor.
Okay.
Right? And the individual said, from this point on, you have my trust. I don't care where you came from. I don't know what your story is, but you have 100% of my trust right now. My trust is yours to lose, right? So it kind of put the ball in my court. It no longer was things happening to me. I had agency in which to that I could fulfill the expectations, because the expectations were already high and I didn't have all that baggage coming along with me.
Absolutely, Russ. And one of the things about those sailors is, you know, the ability to give away that trust or make decisions that erodes that trust is a much different perch to work from than one feeling like they're digging out of a hole.
Exactly.
So if I had reached back to those divisions and carried forward or made truth, whether they were or not, all of the fallacies of the past, that sailor would have said, well, it wasn't fair then and it won't be fair now, so why should I even try?
Mm-hmm.
And that opened a door, turned a page for them. And some of those sailors, I will tell you, one in particular, super tough kid from the streets of Chicago, no one could seem to get through him, ended up being the sailor of the year.
Nice.
And so it just showed the power of personal growth, mm-hmm. right? That people can make mistakes and move on, but that someone believing in you, and someone looking you in the eye and say, it's yours. Go see what you can do with it, and I'm here to support, right? There's a different dynamic in that. And so not only as individuals in their own career paths, as a team, they came together, and the unit identity, the camaraderie, the partnership also helped them, because in a social setting where they had been ostracized possibly, they had a whole new connection about the ship that they didn't have before that carried on with them as well.
What a wonderful story, and certainly something that we can all learn from and then apply as we move forward. Thank you for sharing that. So we're going to take a step back. We've been down on the in the micro level. So let's go to a high altitude, kind of take a 30,000 foot view, and talk about collaborative partnerships in an increasingly interconnected world. How do you envision the Navy collaborating with other branches of the military, allied nations, and even civilian organizations to address our complex global challenges that are happening right now?
Yeah, you know, I just had the high honor of participating in a forum called Statecraft at the Supreme Court, which mm-hmm. brought together a number of the organizations you just spoke of. Inter-military organizations, every service, the joint staff, as well as ambassadors, legislators, agency representatives, foreign countries. Mm-hmm. And it highlighted yet again the increasing urgency with which we must partner strategically, day in and day out, on all fronts across the diplomatic, information, military, and economic, to ensure that all nations that have shared values are able to defend themselves against sort of the axis of evil that is out there today, because our near-peer competitors are making ever-increasing and more rapid advances in their own capabilities that threaten democracies, literally worldwide. How do I see it happening? There are a million decisions that are made every single day, literally from, you know, the White House on down
uh-huh.
to Congress, to the Pentagon, to the fleets, right, in which there is opportunity to further strengthen our partnerships. There's a saying that says, hey, it's not in conflict, in which we want to, you know, cold call somebody and try to establish a relationship. Mm-hmm. The importance of that communication, of that interoperability, of that understanding, of that sharing of information, as we had today from one of the speakers on intelligence, happens in the white space between the conflicts. And so taking advantage and leaning forward and expanding the envelope, opening the door, extending a handshake, leaving a card, making a phone call, having a cup of coffee, at every level of our organizations, internal and external to the United States, we should be strengthening those partnerships.
Right.
And the codification of that will come in policies, regulations, laws, treaties, alliances, all of that. But the need to do so goes down to the individual. We are both military officers And we are ambassadors as well,
mm-hmm.
both to the civilian community that we support and we defend, right, but also to our foreign allies and friends who also wear our uniform. So taking advantage every single day to assure that openness, that shared value, and looking for opportunities where in each of our spaces we can further those relationships.
Right.
I think the opportunities are untold and increasingly important.
Yeah, I mean, as we've looked out there, I mean, you mentioned you used the phrase axis of evil. A lot of folks don't understand that that so-called axis of evil was more apparent, say, back in World War II, and that's what we called it. And you could see those alliances being made. And so far, in if you're looking back in the last couple of decades, our adversaries, now when I say our, I don't mean U.S. adversaries, I mean adversaries of democracy and adversaries of freedom, they were working independently, and it seems that in the last few years that they are making those collaborative efforts. They are creating those relationships amongst themselves, and just like we make ourselves stronger with relationships, they're making themselves stronger with relationships. So it's even more important now than it ever was, both to, as a nation, strengthen our relationships, as an armed service, strengthening our relationship with the other armed services, and even within the Navy, to strengthen our relationships so that when things do get adverse, as for lack of a better term, that we can rely on one another and we know that somebody's got our back. So we are at about the perfect window for about one more serious question,
okay,
and then one more fun question, and then we're going to wrap our session. So as an individual, adaptive leadership is important, and especially as we are aging and at a different generation and a different point and than some of our new coworkers, our new sailors, and so forth. In today's rapidly challenging technological landscape, right, how do you ensure that your leadership style remains relevant and effective?
First, I appreciate that you called me old, Russ. I won't take offense to that. I, in all seriousness, you're absolutely right. The sailors that are joining the Navy today, the officers that are joining today are, first of all, leaps and bounds, more intelligent, more savvy, right, more adept at some of the technologies that are out there and are commonplace, and the world is better for that.
Mm-hmm.
To that end, though, you know, I think as the senior leaders in the service, our first job is to simply recognize that and not be afraid of it, right? And to seek commonality and understanding as to where we better communicate, right? The newsletter of old is not how we do things anymore, right? Uh-huh. It is now technological communications, you well know, right?
Right.
How do we reach the customers? And the sailors are our customers,
mm-hmm.
And they are our team. So how are they best fed information? How do they prefer to receive information is the first thing. So understanding the landscape and the domain and the mediums, I think, is incumbent upon us as leaders. But second of all, and again, it's sometimes counterintuitive to senior leaders, but listening to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up in a Navy and a military sometimes where your opinion, you know, was not to be had because
right.
your voice was not in the conversation. Well, we don't benefit today from a Navy that is has people beating down the door to get in the service. Mm-hmm. That post 9/11 days that reinforce for us the criticality of our democracy, the threat to our democracy, the freedoms that we enjoy, mm-hmm. it ebbs and it flows. And I hate to say sometimes a natural catastrophe or an attack on those values drives people in the door. And right now we don't see that either
right.
as a community or as a Navy. We're having recruiting problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
And understanding what's driving kids today, what their goals are, what their desires are, how can we best meet them? What are their limitations? How do they see the Navy? Are we feeding into those perceptions? Are we? How can we counter those perceptions? How can we better educate them? And literally, how can we go and meet them in the schoolyards, at the colleges, and things like that
okay.
to better inform them of our mission?
Uh-huh.
And what appeals to them? Is it defense of the democracy? Is it giving something more than yourself? What language will resonate, right? And that's a continuing message that we have to shape. So I think for me, to remain adaptive in that space It requires humility and humbleness.
Mm-hmm.
It requires you be open-minded to something that maybe is not quite what you grew up with, but to the experimentation and the continuous assessment of effectivity. That allows you to be a bit more flexible, right? It's not just the rigid, I said, you go do.
Right.
Right? And because it's just not the way we can actually lead today. And I think there are so many options. The economy allows more choices for mm-hmm. people to leave the Navy, right? And there's always that draw.
Right.
But I think the instilled value of just I should grow up and I should serve because my parents did and because I come from the Midwest, it's just not the same. I think the global reach and the technologies have opened people's eyes to the opportunities out there. From employer standpoints, people are much more transient in what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So just pinning our rose on, well, because you should or because you signed up to do it or because you will look disloyal or unpatriotic,
right.
That just doesn't pass anymore.
Right.
So speaking to people as humans and connecting them and giving them a self-instilled desire to continue to be a part of, to continue to give, to continue to sacrifice, that's the trick in the new leadership styles.
Right. I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, when you mentioned being a single mother, and, you know, I'm a parent as well, and my youngest is now 17, and sometimes as I get older, it was different when relating to my oldest children because I was younger, and now to be honest, it's a little harder to connect with my youngest because I am older. And even though it seems counterintuitive, like, look, you're the parent, you have this obligation. And we're talking kind of like how you're talking about the new sailors. Like, you can't say it's your obligation to do these things. You gotta meet them where they're at.
You have to find their motivation.
Right.
Nowadays, there's no more obligation because they don't feel obligated for anything. You know, the things that they enjoy the benefit of were given to them. So it's not as though it's the World War II generation where they knew what we fought for.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense of obligation, right, and doing your part and sacrifice is inherent because they experienced it. They lived it. Generationally, some of these kids just don't connect with even 9/11, right?
I
was in the Pentagon on 9/11. My child was in the Pentagon on 9/11.
Oh,
I was pregnant with my second son on 9/11. And so it very intuitively, although ironically on that day, I had made the decision to get out of the Navy and was waiting to go tell my boss. The next day, of course, I'm not going to do that because I felt the obligation to serve. And
right.
I've stayed since. But you cannot rely on those same things because they're not palatable. And
mm-hmm.
they don't ring in the heartstrings of today's children.
Yeah, and we as you know, leaders have to realize that, as you said, being humble and understand that things are not the same, and doesn't matter how much we don't want them to be that way, we just have to be honest with ourselves and, hey, that's the way it is. So what we're going to do is we're going to wrap real quick, and I have a short and easy question for you,
okay.
Kind of lighthearted. I see on your chest there you've got your surface warfare pin, and so I can assume that you've spent some time on a naval vessel.
Yes.
Hardy har.
A little bit of time.
A little sarcasm. Okay. So your best shipboard meal. What is your favorite shipboard meal and why?
My best shipboard meal is waffles and strawberry and ice cream with whipped cream during brunch on Sundays on the aircraft carrier.
Wow.
Yes, yeah. And I think it was because, you know, I did four deployments of some duration, two on an amphib and two on a carrier.
Uh-huh.
And the supply team writ large ran long and hard, just as the whole aircraft carrier did. And Sunday mornings were always a day where you got just a little extra sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You were allowed to stay, you know, in some comfortable clothes a little bit longer. We kind of didn't get going until noon, right? So back at the Naval Academy where I went to school, there was always one meal, and it was strawberries with, you know, waffles and ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it weirdly indulgent, but it also was a little bit of a creature comfort, right? It broke the paradigm of eggs and bacon and whatever, and
right.
you had the ice cream on the side, and it was kind of a moment just to almost be a kid. And so I think for me it was the tempo and the camaraderie and the climate just for those few hours on a Sunday morning was always a bit more relaxed. And I think kind of that meal in particular for me just reminded people that we were still human. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit of a ray of sunshine on a plate. people always kind of joked about, you know I shouldn't be eating it, but here I go.
Nice.
And so I think it was a little escapism. And so for me, it's a very simple thing. But, you know, as we get older, it's the simple things that we really actually enjoy. And so for me, it just brought a little bit of happiness. So and people became a kid a little bit with, oh, I'll take an extra scoop of ice cream and I'll run it off on the treadmill later. So it was always a point of conversation, but it was always kind of like a kid in a candy store is what it reminded me of.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I really, again, want to thank you for taking the time. Obviously, you're here for another reason. So thank you for taking the time, allowing us to get to know you a little bit better and kind of get a little bit of insight as a, you know, you're obviously a successful leader and what it takes and what maybe we can do to emulate. So that's time for us. This has been Inside Navy Supply. I'm Russ Stewart, and that is all we've got. Over and out.